Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm here to introduce our next speaker. I've known Brian since he started tapping his way into our meetings. Usually you heard him before you actually got to see him. But I'm really excited that he's able to speak at this gratitude meeting for us. Brian's courage, strength, and hope is so very empowering. Please help me welcome Brian M.
Hi, everybody. My name is Brian. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I'd like to tell everybody the microphones are working now. I'm kind of nervous. I'd like to thank the program committee for asking me to speak today, and to Jeffrey and Sharon. I'm very honored and moved that they want to hear my story. My story starts as the classic alcoholism story. I come from a family of five, and I'm a Bronx Irish Catholic, and my father was the classic alcoholic. He never held a steady job, and he drank, he still drinks. He was the father of five children who he never supported, and he was very abusive emotionally and physically, and it seemed to be just a part of everyday life, and I didn't find anything wrong with it. I had my mother's three sisters and my mother, and so I had four mothers altogether, and they kind of supported us through school and kept us going as a family. And looking back, it was kind of tough times, but we got by. And at the age of three, I was diagnosed as a diabetic, and I grew up with diabetes, and it just became part of my life. I never really had made it a special thing, although everybody would always ask the mother, well, how is he? And she'd say, oh, he's just fine. Don't worry about him. He's just fine. So that's kind of the attitude I took about it. You know, I'm just fine. And I was ashamed of my disease. I never had enough of myself to just put it out there that was what I had. I always kept my disease a secret, except for a very few close friends of mine. And that carried on all through my life, even up to my early adulthood. In high school, my aunts would take us away once a year. We'd go to Ireland or England or one part of Europe. And in 1979, I went there with my two brothers and my three aunts, and we had a really wonderful time. And 3 weeks after we got home, my two brothers were involved in a very bad car accident. And after one of them was okay with he had a leg injury, and the other one was very critical. He had a head injury. And after 15 days, on the day my brother got out with the leg injury, my other brother passed away. And during this whole process of funerals and arrangements and everything, my mother took on the attitude that no one was to see how we felt. We were supposed to go through this with our heads up and be strong. And one of her favorite songs became Don't Cry Out Loud. And it was, at the time, it was very stoic, but looking back, it was very sick. And, you know, just keep it inside and learn how to hide your feelings. So that's what we did. And even on the day we buried him, every time I started crying, I would get a squeeze in my arm, like, knock it off. We're not supposed to show our emotions. And that kind of became part of me. I felt very betrayed by God, and I lost contact with any sort of spirituality. Not that Catholicism, you know, keeps me going, but it it kind of really pulled the plug. And I said, I really felt let down because I've never prayed so hard in my life, and I thought God would really come through and create the miracle of miracles, and it didn't happen. So I felt very angry and very betrayed. And then life goes on, and I graduated from high school and started my career. And then I went down to Wall Street and started bouncing around jobs there, and finally landed one that was pretty well, a pretty good job, paid well, great benefits, and it was the 80s, the high life of Wall Street, and it was just a great time in my life, and nothing could go wrong. And one morning in early 1989, I went to my sister's house, I slept over her house, and I woke up the next morning, and I couldn't see out of my left eye. I had a big black spot in it, and I said, oh shit, something's going wrong. And for the next few days, you know, I became very concerned, and I went to an eye doctor, and they were telling me that I had retinal bleeding, and it was from my diabetes. And I said, oh, well, what can we do? So we started laser treatments, and I got thrown into the world of ophthalmology, and I was learning things every day about, you know, this disease and what it can do and what you should look out for. And oh, it was something. And I was still dealing with work and trying to see things and trying to have people help me and trying to have my, you know, crew in position to have everything done right, and a little control issue, I guess. And I also met a man at the same time, and I figured, you know, the first time I met him, you know, just be all right. And the second time I met him, I said, I think this is going to be serious, because I found it quite attracting, and I didn't have to think about what I was going through. And also, he was the first person I opened up to, and I let him know exactly what was going on. And I told him about my disease, and I told him about my eyes, and I said, I'm not in a good spot. And then he turned around and told me he was married and he had a wife and two kids. So he was totally unavailable, and I was totally in love. And that's the way the romance started, and we went on, and things didn't get better, things got worse. And for the next year, I went through a lot with my eyesight, and it just kept diminishing and diminishing, and I finally went through these series of operations, and it just didn't work. And I had a detached from my job. I had to fight for my health benefits. They wanted to take them away from me, and they were saying they didn't receive the letters that I sent and the applications, and it was a very big battle. And I had to sign up for rehab to try to, you know, learn how to walk around with a cane and get mobile. And I had to go through the red tape of the blind person's support network, and it was hard, and it was kind of oppressing. I felt depression as a blind person for the first time, and I didn't know it was what it was while I was going through it. And I still didn't feel very good. I felt very sick. I was very tired, and I was just sick. I would get up, and I'd want to go back to bed. And I went to my, 6 weeks after my second eye operation, I went to the doctor, and I said, I don't feel good. I think something went wrong with the operation. I think these are the lasting effects from the anesthesia. And he did some tests, and he called me up, and he said, I think you have to make an appointment with this doctor. He was the nephrologist, a kidney doctor. And I said, no, this can't be happening. And I went to this doctor then, and he told me my kidneys were failing. And I said, fuck. Excuse me, but it was just like... I just couldn't believe that this was going on. And I was living at home half the week, and half the week I'd be down in that one's apartment, my man. And I didn't know like which way to turn. And by this point, I wasn't doing too good on the relationship front either, but you know, who knows. We celebrated our second anniversary, and the next night, from a group of men who he knew who were fathers, he said, I'm going to an Al-Anon meeting. And I said, Al-Anon? And I had been to an Al-Anon meeting with my mother when I was about 14, and she just cried through the whole thing and said, what do I need? I know what Dave's going through. I'm going through the same thing. So... of course, I went with him because I wouldn't trust him in a room full of men. And I said, well, I'll go with you. So I went with him, and we went to the Friday night men's meeting. And I came out of there, and I said, I've heard all their stories before. I'm living their stories. You know, and I was just like a carbon copy of my mother. And we went to Manitou's after that, and... I said to my friend Jack, what's this God shit all about? I don't understand. Everybody had to say something about God. God this, God that. I said, you know, it got a little tired after a while. And he said, well, God can be a bird. God can be a bus. And I was like, this guy's as crazy as those ones inside. I was like, oh, man. So I said, all right, we'll see, you know. I just brushed it off, and we went on, and the next night I went to a meeting, and a woman was sharing about her brother. He was going through his process of dying, and she was having a hard time because she didn't know if he could hear her. And I was on the other side of the room, and I was crying just as hard because I was back in my brother's room not knowing if I could. What I was saying was being heard by him, and I wasn't in the room anymore. I was back in the hospital, and I went through this whole process. It was very, very strong and very moving. And I said, "Oh." For the whole next week, I went through a grieving process that I wasn't able to do when it was happening. And I said, "If this program can do that to me, there's something to it, and I got to find out about it." So I started going to meetings, and at the same time, I was my kidneys were still failing at a slow rate, and I started getting my information about what my choices were, and my doctor kept telling me I had to do dialysis first and then go, maybe if we got a match and everything worked out right, that we'd go for a transplant. And I said, I don't know. I said, well, why can't I just go for a transplant? He said, well, we find better results or... if you go on dialysis first. And I didn't want any part of dialysis. I guess if I had to, I would have. I started getting my information, and it was quite a struggle. And I was going to my meetings all the time. The Monday night Colia meeting, I owe a tremendous amount of gratitude to, because the people in that meeting taught me so much. I was like a sponge in that room. I soaked up every bit of it. And it was just tremendous what I got from that room. And I was learning Braille, I was learning mobility, I was learning my Al-Anon, and I was learning about kidney disease, and I started making my choice to have a transplant. So I presented this to my family, and we had to go for blood tests, my two brothers and my sister. We went for, you know, the meetings for information, and we went for the blood tests, and my two older brothers, my oldest brother wasn't a very good match. They do this rating of six out of a six antigen match. A six antigen is a perfect match, and a slide scale down from that is the farther you get away from six, the worse it is. So my oldest brother was a one, and my sister was a three, and my second oldest brother, who I don't get along with, and we have really bad personality conflicts, he was a six. And he found out on a Monday night, right before I was leaving. I lived in the Bronx at the time, and I was like, oh man, he's going to put me through so much in order to just do this, and he's going to hold on to it forever. I'm going to owe him. I'm going to have to do things to him. And I went through this whole process, and I realized that it wasn't him that had the problem. It was me. And I had to really work on me to find out, like, you know, to get open and get on with this thing in order to get myself to do it. Because I was very good at telling everybody else what to do, but I didn't know how to tell myself what to do. And so he did. He went to his, then he had to go for a physical, and they found out he was overweight, he had high blood pressure, and he wasn't going to be able to do it. And then my sister volunteered, and she said, well, if they want you, they can have, you know, I'll do it. And she went for her physical, and she passed, and we were on. And she had a year-old child, a three-year-old child, and a husband in a house, a new home. And so she kept offering it to me, and she said, don't worry about it. And I was buying her phones, and I was buying her, you know, things just to try to, I don't know what I was trying to do. I thought I could, I guess, cushion it by buying her things. And we had a good relationship, but I wasn't used to receiving things. And this was a gift that I couldn't repay. And we were going to go on. So we did. But going back a bit, at the meantime, my that man left and went back to his family. And we had a very explosive argument. And on the night he threw me out of his house, I had my cane to his face, and I was ready to push it right through his cheekbone. He had gotten me so incensed, and I'd gone back to a spot I was with my father where I was holding the knife and ready to put it through his stomach. And that's how destructive this disease is. And I couldn't believe it. And standing in the middle of this man's home, I had my cane like a knife ready to just do it to him. And a voice came to me and said, get out. And I did. And when I was in the cab going home, I realized that I had become my mother and this man had become my father. So I was taken right after him. So I was now stuck with being home and all the time. Where before I had a choice of two evils, now I had only one, and it was the original one. And I was looking out the window one day, and my father was sitting on the couch, and he was going through his regular dementia that he goes through when he's drunk. And I said, if I'm going to sit here and listen to this shit till the day I die, I said, I'm not going to do it with this man. I said, I've had enough. And it was really powerful to think that that's what made me move. Like, I wouldn't do it for myself, but I'd do it to get away from him. And I had made the decision to get an apartment, and I found an apartment, and I moved into it. And we started then the process of getting ready for my kidney transplant with my sister. We went for blood tests and education and talked to people who had had them. And we were ready to start transfusions. I was going to receive my sister's blood, and we did. I had one transfusion of her blood, and I was also scheduled to qualify at the Friday night meeting. I was 10 months in program and a little bit nervous. But I also had gotten a phone call from the surgeon at the hospital one night, and I thought it was from results of the blood tests they were taking. And I got very upset, and I called Jack again. Thank you for being there, Jack. And I thought my numbers had fallen, or I had to go on dialysis, and I was extremely upset. And Jack said, well, just wait and see what happened. And when he called me back, the doctor called me back, he said, well, I'd like you to come in tomorrow morning at 8:30. And I said, well, what seems to be the problem? He said, well, I'd like to talk to you tomorrow about it. I said, no, you have me on the phone right now. Let me know right now what's going on. And he said, well, we have to talk about your homosexuality. And I said, but what about it? And he said, well, it's just something we have to discuss because there are, you know, HIV issues and this and that. I said, but I'm not positive. What's your problem? And he said, well, we just got to discuss it because, you know, there's this window period, and if you're practicing unsafe sex, I said, how do you know what kind of sex I'm having? And how do you know what my lifestyle is? I said, I think you're assuming a lot, doctor. So, I had, I had hung up the phone. I agreed to meet him the next morning, and I started to make countless number of program calls, and everybody, and again, getting information and getting an education. I went up there, and I sat on the 4 train up to the Bronx, and I said, serenity prayer after serenity prayer after serenity prayer after serenity prayer. And I went in there, and I just blew them away, and I just said, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't think I have the problem here. I think it's your problem. And, you know, you have to deal with it, you know. And it was the first time now I had gone through feeling oppressed as a handicapped person, feeling oppressed as a diabetic. And now for the first time I was being challenged as a gay man in this society. And I was incensed. I wouldn't take it. And I wouldn't let him intimidate me to think that I wasn't going to have this operation. So it went on, and I qualified then at the Friday night meeting. I had qualified earlier at a Saturday night meeting I was leading because the speaker didn't show up. And I let out a little bit, but not a lot. But at this Friday night meeting, I had qualified everything, and I let out my whole story. And one of the last things I said was, I'd like to work on getting a better relationship with my mother, and I'd also like to build a bridge to God because I have no trust in God. And maybe if I had trust in God, I'd have a little more trust in myself. And the next day, earlier that week, I had gotten a phone call. I didn't realize I was on a list, and I had gotten a phone call that there was a kidney available, but I was number 2 on the list. It was a 5 out of 6 match. And there was somebody who was number 1 also, and if they didn't take it, I was up for it. And I said, okay, fine. And I ran to the hospital and got the blood test done and waited, and number 1 took it. And I said, good for them. And Friday night I had qualified that, and I was getting ready Saturday afternoon to go out, and the phone rang, and it was the hospital again. They said, oh, this is Montefiore Hospital, and we have a kidney for you. And I said, no, we went through this last week. And I said, you know, we've been through it already. I think it's already been done. And they said, no, we have another kidney available this morning. Early this morning, we got a phone call, and you're number 1 on the list. And it's a 6 out of 6 match. You have to come up here if you want to. Thank you. You have to come up here and get your test done if you want this. And I said, all right, I'll be there. And I went, I got my stuff got my pajamas and my silk robe, and and I went up there, and I did the test, and I went to my mother's house to wait for the yes or the no, because the whole time going up there, I said, this ain't going to happen, and if it does happen, I'm not going to survive it. You know, it was my disease at work. But at the same time, I had this strange inner peace that was going on that just paced me through the whole thing. When I got to my mother's house, my father was drunk again, of course, and the dementia was going on. It was just the same craziness. And I just waited, and I waited for 7 hours. It was about 11:30 at night, and I had contacted a few people then, and I said, all right. And 11:30, the phone rang, and they said, come on in. You know, you're almost ready. And I said, oh, all right. And still went up there thinking that this ain't going to go on. Denial was a very strong thing at times. And took some tests again and waited. And at the next morning at 6:30, they came in. The anesthesia man came in, and I was like, I was in this like mode that it was like a Stepford wife in the hospital. And I realized, you know, that's all I kept telling. Okay, fine. And I realized that I was living a second at a time, because I didn't know what was going to happen, and I didn't want to go up there and find out like I usually did. I just stayed in the second, and it worked. And when they came in and said I had 10 minutes, I called my mother, and I said, all right, I'll talk to you, or come up and see me later. I'd sent her home earlier because she was getting on my nerves, and I said, please go home. And then I called my sponsor, and my sponsor read to me, which I was going to read to you today, but I forgot on my tape recorder. He read a passage for me about being human and being held, and it's okay to be held, it's okay to be touched, it's okay to be a human being, and it's okay to be in touch with God. And I said, okay, I love you. I hung up the phone, and they came and they took me and gave me a few Valium, and I was nice and high by the time I went down there, and met the surgeon, and then I said a little serenity prayer in my head. And when I woke up, it felt physically kind of weird, but something else was going on. I couldn't put my finger on it, and it was that, as you know, the few days went on, I just kept getting rushes of this energy and this warmth and this love, and I'll never forget it. It was it was wonderful, and I knew it wasn't physical. And as I thought about people, they called, and things were happening. And I remember June called me, and she congratulated me. I said, yeah, can you believe it? I got it. And she said, yeah, you certainly got it. And I finally, it came together that, you know, I had gotten it. You know, a sense of God. And God was with me, and I was truly blessed. And it was just really overwhelming to think that somebody who just signed us a little piece of paper had given me such a gift, and that I had received it, and that it worked. And as the days went on, they told me it was, it had come from Seattle, Washington, and it was a woman, so I'm part lesbian too. I should have worn my waterproof mascara. And As I figured out the timetable of events that occurred while I was qualifying that Friday night, this woman was losing her life in Seattle. And it was just undeniable that I had gone through a miracle. And there's nothing that can beat a miracle at the time, you know. And it was like Patti LaBelle, my favorite, says, when you've been blessed, it's like heaven. And that's what had happened. It was like heaven. And it was time to build a new life. And I didn't know what I was to do. I didn't want to go back to business. And I didn't know what to do. I still don't know what to do. But I'm playing with things now. And I get an income for doing nothing, so I can afford to. You know, I got a better, my family went through a lot with me, and I have somewhat better relationship with them. But I came to last year's round, I came to the first roundup 2 years ago, and I was very impressed with their play. And then I came to last year's roundup, and I was glad to be in it, and I thought that was wonderful. And then the Lighthouse sponsors a theater group with visually impaired and blind people, and I was in that last year, and this year, thank you, Richie and Chris, they let me in this year, too. And that's been, like, a wonderful experience that I think I can call myself an actor now. And that kind of works for me. And the one thing I know now is that I'm okay with Brian, and I'm okay with myself. And I still love that man somewhat, and I love my family a lot. And it's not that I love them any less. It's just that, you know, for me today, I love when people say that. For me today, I love myself a whole lot more, and I wouldn't be able to do that unless I had a lot of outstanding support from all of you. And that's why I'm at where I am today, and it's because of that support. I'm also a somewhat advocate for the transplant community, and now that I have you here, I can tell you to sign a donor card, please. And it's been a really tremendous experience. And if you told me 2 years ago, I was thinking about this week, and 2 years ago when I walked in here, I was a mess. And not that I'm perfect today, but I couldn't believe what has transpired from that time. And it truly is, a grateful space that I'm in. And that's what it's about. I appreciate every one of you, and I'm grateful for this program. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.